This Rock Talk podcast recording is an interview and opinion product that is the property of rocksubculture.com, all rights reserved. rocksubculture.com is not responsible for any statements or opinions expressed by the guests of this program. Welcome to Rock Talk, the official podcast for rocksubculture.com. Each podcast features interviews with special guests to discuss all aspects of popular music. rocksubculture.com travels the globe to experience, review, and archive live concert events. Interview those involved in producing and performing a variety of genres of popular rock music, as well as find and learn about related studio and stage use artifacts and memorabilia. Now, let's join our host, Jason DeBoard.
Yeah, and I can be long-winded though, so, you know, we don't have to stick by any set clock.
Okay, so today my guest is Lawrence Gowan from Styx, who is the lead singer and the keyboardist. So welcome to the podcast here.
Thank you, Jason. Love to be potted along.
We were talking a little bit earlier. I'm going to see you perform tonight at Thunder Valley in Lincoln, California. And then you guys are touring the U.S. through the end of November, correct?
That's correct. That will sum up the 104 Styx shows of 2012.
Wow!
In November, although I think there's also a few actually just before New Year's, but before New Year's Eve. But it's another year where the insatiable demand around the world to see Styx is being addressed.
Yeah. Well, that's awesome because, you guys have such an awesome catalog of work and it seems like you've got a real cross-generational appeal to, fans that have been there from the beginning and people that, weren't even alive in the 80s and even the 90s that are, big fans of your guys' work today.
Well, that's what's emerged actually in the last 7 or 8 years, and particularly noticeable in the last 5 years, is that at least half the audience of the shows, and it might be more than that tonight when you're there. Who knows? But at least half the audience weren't even around when the biggest selling, let's put it that way, Styx records were originally released, and they've discovered the band, through all kinds of ways.
Yeah.
Other than your podcast, they probably discovered it through, just poking around on the internet or hearing, the Styx referenced in all kinds of pop culture things like South Park or the Big Daddy movie that Adam Sandler did, or on Scrubs, or, various ways.
Now, you were born in Scotland and then you grew up predominantly in Canada. Is that correct?
Correct. Yes, I was born in Scotland, and then family immigrated to Canada when I was just a little kid, and so I grew up in Toronto, and but I always had the kind of the cross current influences of British music and American influences always coming into my life, and that really kind of gave me I like the perspective you get on music, particularly being in Canada, because it still has a lot of the British traditions and roots would present themselves in all kinds of ways.
Yeah, well, that's what's kind of interesting is, you started recording in like the late 70s, early 80s. Is that right?
Actually, my first solo record was in 1982.
Okay.
I had a band in the late 70s for 5 years that played, over that 5-year period, we played probably about 1,500 shows. And it was a great kind of learning ground as to how to write music, how to perform it, night after night. But it wasn't really a recording entity. But when the band broke up, I got a solo record deal with Columbia Records in Canada and started my solo career in 1982. And that kind of I don't want to say concluded, but it went on hiatus, let's put it that way, in 1999 when I joined Styx.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you were, you know, during the 80s in Canada, did you find that maybe you were in a unique position because you've got kind of some American music since we're on the same continent, and then you also got some of the influences from England as well?
Well, yeah, that's more or less what I was referring to, particularly when it came to writing. Yeah, we were exposed to some bands in Canada that get exposure in Canada from the UK are not necessarily heard that much in the United States. It's not true for all of them, but it just gave me a good kind of cross reference, and I wound up working with musicians who were both British, Canadian, and American. Starting with my second album, when I had Peter Gabriel's rhythm section of Tony Levin and Jerry Marotta, and also his guitarist David Rhodes and another British guitarist named Chris Jarrett, mm-hmm. a British producer named Dave Tickle, and we made an album called Strange Animal, and that record went on to be a triple platinum success in Canada and got to number one, and you know, but for various reasons, back the way the music industry was structured back then, it was never released in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Funny enough, this morning I heard the Tears for Fears song "Shout" on the radio, and it reminded me because in 1985 I wound up opening their national tour in the United States, trying to kind of force the hand of CBS in the U.S. to release the album.
Hmm.
And but it never did. It's just the way the music industry was structured back then. Sometimes an artist was locked into his own country, similar to what I was just referring to with some British acts that saw some exposure in Canada, but not the United States.
Yeah. So, you know, in your career then, you've obviously seen, and maybe more than some people, kind of had a better understanding of the music industry and how much it's changed now, where everything's really international and, with the internet and downloadable music, and it's kind of like erased a lot of those borders and boundaries, right?
Well, just the mere fact that you and I are speaking right now, the fact that this can be listened to anyone around the world is mm-hmm. such a
yeah, it's a trip.
seismic change in how music gets to people now I was used to it where it was very locked up and controlled,
mm-hmm.
and hey, listen, it worked for them. That's how they built a music industry,
right?
You know, that was so phenomenally successful, as everyone knows, and that's the genie they can't get back into the bottle,
right? So exactly.
But it puts musicians in a different position now, where we have worldwide access to virtually everything we do.
Right. Now, you had a lot of success, you know, in your solo career, and then you opened for Styx, what, in like 96 or 97 at one point?
Yeah, that was a kind of a, I guess it was a faded night, because I had a record that year that I actually had a French record that had gotten into the top 10 in Quebec, which is the French region of Canada.
Mm-hmm.
And I enjoyed a lot of success there. And, you know, we, Styx and I, had the same promoter promoting both of our shows on the same night. And that promoter, Donald, asked if instead of me playing the theater, would I open the show for Styx at what was the New Montreal Forum
mm-hmm.
that year. So that's the big arena where the hockey teams play. And so I accepted that, even though I hadn't opened for anyone in Canada since, I guess 1985. I'd never opened
wow.
for anyone, and so, but I wanted to play that new arena so badly, and
yeah,
I'd never seen Styx live, so I thought, well, here's a good opportunity. So it was one of those nights when the band became aware of my music. I guess they'd heard some of the songs whenever they toured through Canada, but they really became kind of acutely aware of it because they heard the crowd singing along with all these songs. And when I came off, Tommy made the curious remark that, you know, we should work together again sometime in future, you know. 2 years later, they called, and I was offered the position of being their new keyboard player and singer. So that was, I'm into my 14th year with the band now, and this lineup has played more shows than any previous Styx lineup ever have.
Yeah.
Including being before Tommy Shaw was in the band. And so it's been a very successful ride, and one that I've you know, as you mentioned before, I've observed a lot of changes in the music industry. I've observed a lot of changes in the Styx fans around the world, as we talked about, where the age range is just, it's from young kids right up to people who were there when the records were originally released and even beyond. So it's quite a remarkable thing to be a part of.
Yeah. Now, what do you think you personally brought to the band that was kind of different or maybe new or unique, you know, in terms of like the live performances?
I guess the simplest answer would be a spinning piano. Because I did bring that with me.
Yeah.
I remember, it's funny, you know, we joke about that, but it's, we're in rock, you know, where just about everything's been, you know, explored at this point, and you really have to pick and choose what are the best elements to keep championing every day. About 22 years ago now, 1990, I came up with this spinning piano just mainly so that I could, you know, engage the audience in a more effective way, like a guitarist is able to do.
Right.
And when I came to that first rehearsal with Styx, you know, we had the expected kind of massive, you know, keyboard setup, the one that like Rick Wakeman would use, you know what I mean? The multiple keyboards all around. And
right.
I thought, as much as I loved that, I just said, do you want me to try this, my spinning piano? And I said, yeah, let's give that a shot. And that kind of changed the just the look of what was going on stage.
Yeah.
And, I guess, you know, I don't know all of the history of what, of how the band was prior, but I think the comment that I heard a lot from the other band members was that there was just a renewed energy to the performance in the entire band, and kind of came along when they embraced the notion of taking on the mission of playing Styx around the world as much as possible. They really embraced that. And whereas in the past they had to kind of pick and choose the short little burst of touring that they did, they really wanted to commit themselves to taking the thing out there live and giving the most high energy performance as possible. And I guess I came along when that was the mandate, and I was able to kind of add to that.
Yeah. Now, do you think there's some parallels with Journey, kind of, because they've sort of gone through a similar thing with, you know, a new lead singer, maybe with some more energy, and also a much more active touring schedule, and really kind of sharing that experience and that music kind of around the world? Because you guys have even done some tours together, correct?
Yes, we have. We have. I think on the surface there are similarities, as you pointed out, Jason. But it's funny. I've learned that each band is as unique and unto itself as each family is.
Yeah, you know? I was just gonna say it's like a family, right?
Yeah. So what looks like it's being played out in one one band may seem similar to another, but really each one is so unique and so it's such a delicate balance.
Yeah,
it has to be struck to figure out how to extend the life of a band beyond decades, you
right.
know, instead of it being, you know, the usual trajectory of a band is about 10 years.
Right.
Maybe a bit less than that.
Right.
Before the inevitable kind of backstage dramas rear their head. And
yeah. Well, because, I mean, actual families, you're related to each other. Bands, it's like, you know, you're really just held together by your efforts in making music and performing music, which is a totally different thing. So.
Yeah. Yeah. And you have this, but you have this shared euphoria, euphoric experience of seeing thousands of people standing on their feet at the end of every performance. And that's something that bonds you and kind of galvanizes you to wanting to see the band continue and to continue to do better and better and improve it along the way.
Yeah. Now, I know there's been talk about the band, you know, going all the way back about kind of different directions, like, because with progressive rock, you have kind of that theatrical element, but then there's also like the real rocking guitar and that. So where do you kind of fall with those elements, and which, you know, kind of that balance, or is it just really song by song? Or,
well, it's funny, I guess, you know, because Tommy and JY and Chuck, you know, took the reins of the band right when I joined, they wanted to see a recommitment to it being kind of a heavier rock band and not to be afraid of its progressive rock roots, that it explored and were successful with. And so the first studio record that we did, Cyclorama, really reflected that, and that, I was able to write on all the pieces on that record and bring my own musical sensibility into the arena with the band, so to speak. And I think they basically wanted to continue to kind of accent that aspect of the band, that it's a successful, hard progressive rock band. There's songs like that are anthemic. Songs like
right.
America and Renegade and Blue Collar Man and Grand Illusion or Miss America. They're very they're anthemic, strong, melodically based rock songs that people can't get out of their heads.
Yeah. Well, and they're especially fun to see performed live as well.
Yeah.
You've obviously written a ton of songs on your own and now it sticks as well. What do you think really makes a song a big hit? Or is it just sort of a magical thing that happens,
That's always a great question because I don't think it's one to which there's a definitively satisfactory answer. My own inclination is to say that there's magic or there's some kind of voodoo in a melody that you just cannot walk away from. Something that just keeps recurring in your mind once you've heard it, and then becomes part of your the soundtrack to your life,
right,
so to speak.
Right.
And I don't know what that is, and I don't know if I want to really, analyze it in a scientific laboratory to find out what it is. It's I think there's a quote in the movie Immortal Beloved, which is the story of Beethoven, where he says, "Music, what is it? You can't touch it. You can't taste it. You can't feel it." We're constantly trying to divine what is the actual, secret sauce,
right,
so to speak, that's in there. And I keep coming back with that. And I use it as an example for my own beliefs. The fact that the Beatle music continues to be the kind of ground zero central, force that so many generations respond to.
Yeah.
Well, the melodies are just, they're so infectious. You can't really walk away from them. And then luckily, the lyrical content happens to support everything that the melody is kind of, hinting at. And so those two things combined in perfect measure just seem to have a tremendous effect upon people and enrich their lives to some degree. Now, the level of quality that you bring to that is really what determines whether a band, really makes a profound impact on people or if it's just something that kind of has a limited appeal.
Right. Well, you did a studio album, Big Bang Theory, that's covers.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
It opens with a Beatles song. Was there a big debate about which Beatles song to cover?
There wasn't a debate, actually. What happened was we were playing at Eric Clapton's Blues Fest in Dallas that year, and I had played I'm the Walrus, actually. I used to do it as an encore piece when I did my solo tours. And J.Y. heard me playing it one day in soundcheck, and he said, there's so many great blues artists here this weekend. We should do something a bit different, but something that Clapton is connected to in some way.
Mm-hmm.
He said, why don't we just learn I'm the Walrus, do a Styxified version of that song. So we did it we did a pretty brief rehearsal of it, but we played it the next day, and it went live out over the radio. And actually, one of the most curious parts of that, and this is something I'm going to start mentioning more, Billy Preston was sitting side stage when we actually did that. It's just a coincidental thing that I remember looking over and seeing his big smile and his, unmistakable look at the guy and realizing, hey, here's the keyboard player from the Beatles. And we're playing a Beatles song. And maybe within 3 hours of us kind of getting back to the hotel. After that, our manager called and said, I'm getting calls from a radio station and they're getting a bunch of requests for the sixth version of I'm the Walrus.
Oh, wow.
So that's how the whole album kind of unfolded, was from that we realized, well, let's find some other songs that really influenced us as young, you know, hopeful musicians, and went on to have an impact on our lives. And so that's why we did the album Big Bang Theory. And it must have been good, because, you know, just a couple of years later, they named a TV show after it.
Yeah. Good show too. Yeah. So what's your favorite song to perform live?
Well, because it shifts all the time, you know. I mean, this year we released a DVD of Styx doing the full Grand Illusion album and the full Pieces of Eight album back to back at a show that we recorded last year in Memphis. There were songs on those two records that I think were either ignored or maybe even never played live that suddenly became kind of favorites of mine to play. I love the title track, Pieces of Eight. I really enjoy playing that song. There's an instrumental piece on that record called Aku Aku that I really always wanted to know if we could play that live, and finally we did. Castle Walls from the Grand Illusion album is a great piece. Mm-hmm. I love doing that. But I guess, so those are the kind of new discoveries new discoveries of great old, Styx songs that have risen in my, my estimation of what I like to play the most. But, you know, every night, wherever we play around the world, by the time we play Renegade, I always marvel at, you know, I can never ignore the look on the audience's faces, whether we're in Japan or in Sweden or in America or in Mexico or even in Canada. You know, there's always this similarity, because, you know, the experience of the concert has kind of leveled everyone to this place where they're all in this kind of great, you know, elated state, you know. Mm-hmm. And so I, because I really only sing in that one at the opening and the middle section, I get to kind of observe that and drink
right.
it in. And so that makes it the most enjoyable piece for me, because, I'm in a good place by the time we play that every night.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it seems like one thing that can be said is you seem to have a lot of fun on stage, and you really seem to just eat it up and just love performing.
I think that's another aspect of why people, you know, keep coming back. It's an infectious thing, the fun that we have, as you say, on stage, and just the way that kind of permeates its way out to the audience, and the music really calls for that anyway. I mean, they're fun pieces to play.
Yeah. Well, I know we're probably running out of time. I just wanted to thank you for reaching out to me today and let me do this interview with you. And I'm really looking forward to seeing you guys perform tonight.
Good. Absolutely. My pleasure, Jason. And I know you're going to enjoy the show. I'm confident in that.
Yeah.
And you'll be able to go out and tell the whole world about it.
Yeah, I will.
Make that the center of your existence from now on. All right.
All right. Well, thanks so much. And good luck tonight. I'll be out there. I'll be one of those people that have that look on their face that they're really enjoying themselves.
I look forward to seeing that.
All right.
All right, Jason.
All right. Cheers. Thanks a lot.
Thank you for listening to our program, Rock Talk. For the latest gig archives, articles, and features about popular music and concert events around the world, please visit us online at www.rocksubculture.com.
Can't even say Moose Busters.